Hello, welcome back to a new episode of Content Rookie. I say this every week, but I'll say it again. It's a really exciting one today, and that's again thanks to my brilliant guest today, Bill Kurland. We are going to talk about how being part of a counterculture can teach you things about content design or make you a better content designer, specifically from Bill's experience interested in punk. I think this is a really interesting conversation. I left it mostly unedited, which means this episode is a little bit longer. It also means the sound quality isn't 100% there, but I hope you'll enjoy it anyway. I would love to hear your thoughts on this. I think this is a really cool topic. Bill also wrote an article about this that you can find linked in the info box. And I would love to hear what you think about this, about Bill's punk rock history and how that has influenced his content design work. And, you know, I also share a little bit about my counterculture vibes that aren't punky, but another culture. Thanks so much for tuning in. Bill, welcome to Content Rookie. Why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Nicole, pleasure to be here. So I'm Bill Kurland. I'm a lead content designer who's been in content for the last 10 years or so at various organizations, working in everything from SEO and advertising to marketing and UX, and now really focused in the content design space and have been for the last couple of years.
Cool. I know you're pretty active on your socials, specifically on LinkedIn. That's kind of how we started talking to each other and getting in touch. Before we kind of kick off with the main topic of this episode, I was curious to just hear your thoughts on, like, how do you feel? What are the trends that are currently going on that you see mentioned a lot, for example, on LinkedIn or maybe on Twitter, where you feel like, yeah, this is something that I see more people talking about? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, that's a great question. I just saw, I think you just recently did an episode on this, and Laura Costantino, who's over at, who's a UX writer, was also posting about this. Just a lot of like conversations about like, what does documentation look like and how much documentation is too much documentation, both within the workplace and outside. So like, how many resource lists is useful versus just like overwhelming for either people getting into content design or people who are just trying to like learn more about content design. Like, it feels like we have like the Russian nesting dolls of content resources, right? Where it's like a list of resources to give you, you know, multiple lists of resources. Same with documentation, like in the workplace, how much is actually going to be useful and contextual for content designers or, you know, for product designers when, you know, they have to take on some of the overflow and like, do we have too much or can there never be enough? I think is a topic that's bubbling up.
Yeah, I think that's really cool that you mentioned that. I definitely agree with that. I mean, I say this in a lot of the episodes that I feel like documentation was a little bit of a buzzword for a while. Then it feels like some companies slash some teams really went into the direction of trying to document everything with no sense of how that may be used. And others I see are still really struggling with starting any kind of documentation. So I definitely think that's a really interesting topic. Probably worth creating an episode around that as well.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's like such a rich space to explore for sure. And there are so many different perspectives and so many people who do it really well, like Michael Haggerty Villa, who's, you know, been on so many different like design systems and I think has a really good sense of, you know, how you build those things and how they're more than just the job documentation. But like, he has a great phrase called, digital proximity. So like, how do you put the right guidelines or documentation in front of people at the right time? So it's like, you know, it's like anything else, right? Right
Right.
Content, right time, right person. You know, like we've been saying that for how long, how many decades, but, you know, just internalizing that.
That's true. All right, Bill, thanks so much for kicking us off with these thoughts. Today's topic, however, is around 7 counterculture principles or any kind of counterculture principles that can be useful for content designers, which is based on an article you've written. And when you brought this up, I thought this was super interesting right away because I definitely can relate to a lot of the things that you're mentioning. Have not identified as a punk myself, but definitely as someone very inspired by countercultures and driven by that. So I'm super excited to talk to you about that. So first question, how did you first come up with the idea that there were a lot of counterculture things that you were using in your day-to-day work as a content designer?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it occurred to me not that long ago, probably more recently than I'd like to admit, but I think I was connecting with other content designers and then finding that we had a bit of this shared vocabulary of maybe like some of the reference points that we had, whether that was music or writers or films, some of that kind of stuff where it was like, these are things that are not mainstream, but, you know, more on the periphery. And so that kind of like inspired this idea of like, well, I've, you know, been in this position over the years where like, I just really connect to the types of people who are grouped by some of these principles. And I was curious whether that really did persist throughout content design. So I just posted something on LinkedIn and kind of like asked the community, like, is this real or is this something I'm imagining? And just got a lot of commentary from people around the world in different industries, but all in design or content design, that had like this connection to, you know, whether you want to call it punk or hip hop or, you know, postmodernism or, you know, like whatever you want to call it, just kind of like some of these principles that like connected everybody. So that's when I first started. And that's when I kind of like rooted in this concept of something that's really familiar to me, which is just like punk rock. Like I grew up a punk rock kid, and like that's kind of like where all of this welcome to the world, broaden your horizons kind of like started for me.
Yeah, I think it's really cool that you're sharing that because I personally grew up kind of a hippie, and that was kind of my vibe in high school, specifically the kind of crowd that I hung out with. And I guess there's a lot of in common between those two, well, cultures or however you want to call it, tribes. So when I was reading through your article, I really related to a lot of the things that you were saying, but essentially from like a totally different tribe. So I think that's what makes it so cool that it is quite universal.
Yeah, I love that people are responding in different ways. Like I kind of bucketed it from my experience, but there's also like you said, the hippie culture or, you know, the hip hop culture, which I've reached out about. So it's just really cool that like, you know, these things persist regardless of kind of like the label that we give them.
Right, right. Okay, so in your article, you talk specifically about 7 counterculture principles, but I'm curious, could you walk the audience through them briefly, or you can also go into depth if you want?
Yeah, no, totally. I came up with, you know, 7 or so, and listed them as kind of like 1, which is think outside the genre. So just the idea that I think Bruce Mao, who's a designer, refers to it as whole brain thinking, essentially. So like, how do you, you know, if you're a if you're quote unquote a punk or a hippie or, you know, whatever, like, how do you think outside some of the definitions that have maybe come externally, right? Like, punk isn't necessarily like a bunch of white dudes knocking each other around, like, to three chord rock and roll. Like, it can be something as broad as like free jazz or, you know, doo-wop or hip hop or, you know, kind of almost anything. Like, right. That can all come together. So just this idea of like thinking outside, like, what is prescribed as content or like as words and looking for inspiration in other places. And then the second was really like just this pervasive, like, asking why. Like, I just heard from so many designers, like, that's how they grew up, like, just asking, yeah, but why? And yeah. Not to really like lose that as you move into your profession, like, to have the confidence or I guess bravery to continue to ask why and use that to your advantage.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think asking why is also always a lot about an attitude, almost. Like, feels like it's something that can definitely be nourished during childhood, depending on how you're being parented. Some parents really nourish that, the asking why, that kind of starts for some people in toddlerhood, and others really kind of try to stop that. So I feel like it's also an attitude that can be developed early on, or maybe even later in life, depending on the kind of kids you hang out with. So I definitely think this is a really interesting point you make.
Yeah. I'm curious, what were you like as a kid? Did you ask a lot of why questions? Or were you kind of like, I'm curious, like, your background from like that perspective of if you were like really questioning and curious.
Yeah, I mean, I was a really annoying kid, mainly because I actually grew up when I'm the first of four children, the eldest of four children. We're four girls. And originally when I was born, my parents were super religious. They were actually part of, well, I would define it as a sect. They're not anymore. They left eventually. But I remember from my early childhood, like, going to church a lot and hanging out in these Bible study groups. And one of the first big crises of my life that I only recognized as such much later in life was that they kept talking about, like, dying and then going to heaven and hanging out with, like, all of the people that were also good Christians there. And then you would live forever. And I remember lying in bed, I don't know, age 3, 4, 5, trying to imagine living forever and going to heaven and going there without some of my friends that were obviously not religious. And I couldn't wrap my head around it. Like, it just didn't make any sense. So I remember asking a lot of questions over and over again. My parents got really annoyed with me, and ended up actually not bringing me to Bible study anymore, because I would ask these questions to the other people there as well. And they obviously just started thinking that my parents weren't, like, parenting me religiously enough. So I think maybe that's like an example of how this, for me at least, already showed in childhood. And I think I got really lucky that my parents let me do that, even though they grew up in a quite, well, exclusive space when it comes to this. And I guess they were somewhat also questioning it themselves already, and that's why they ended up leaving. But yeah, it's a very strong childhood memory for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my parents were both hippies of, you know, the baby boomer generation. So they, I think, kind of wrestled with a lot of the, you know, what institutions do we want to believe in and right. What do we not? And they both became teachers. And I think their intent was to have it be like, well, go explore, you know, the world and come to your own conclusions. We're not going to tell you, like, necessarily, like, what the answers are. And I don't know if that was necessarily a, like, teacherly thing or more of a, I was just a kid that was like, I'm going to do it by myself. Like, that is my deal. I'm going to like, I'm not going to take help. I'm going to figure it out. Like, just very bullheaded. And I imagine being a parent to that is kind of like, gets exhausting. So, yeah. And that became kind of like a big part of, like, community for me was like having the bravery to ask for help, to like admit, to be vulnerable enough to say, like, you know, I don't, not only can I not live on my own and succeed, like, I don't want to be that isolated. And so, like, I think this idea of like community, which is really what all of this is, right? Like, is really important to me and has emerged as continuing to be even more and more important, like, as I get older.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think that's super interesting. Cool to hear about your parents and the path that they took. My dad also ended up becoming a teacher/professor. I also think that, like, it was something that kind of triggered him way back, maybe already when I was a kid. Maybe I had something to do with that.
Yeah.
All right. So those were two principles. And you were about to jump into the third one when I interrupted you. So please go ahead.
No, and please do continue to interrupt. Otherwise, you know, like, we'll just be me talking boringly at people. Another is kind of like this concept of beware of the gatekeepers. I know in the punk community, like in Chicago, like during the 90s or early 2000s, which is where I grew up, there was a lot of open-mindedness, but also like a contingent of people who were like, this is the definition of punk. If you don't meet that definition by my standards, then you're cast out and you're not what you claim to be. And I think that can sometimes pop into UX or design, where, you know, people have perhaps been doing it for a while, or saying like, well, this is what UX really is, or this is what content design really is. And my reaction to that is like, to be careful around those people who are, you know, making prescriptions about the things that they do, or who gets let in and who meets a standard. Like, you know, I get that there's a level of that that's I guess just always going to be pervasive in hiring, for example, but like it's just like a lot of people, especially on LinkedIn, who are like this is not UX, and are just like going after people who are like new entrants and are perhaps more focused on the discipline than the people who populate it. And I'm just like, not about that, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that is for me also like such an important point. It's the reason that this podcast even exists. And unfortunately, I feel like, so I started this podcast kind of out of rage over all the gatekeeping 2 years ago now. And unfortunately, I feel like it's gotten worse since then. I'm not really sure what's going on. It feels like there's some, I would almost call it snobbery going on in the content design community, in the UX/design community for sure, but now also among content designers. I think that's really sad. Like, it really is not rocket science. And I feel that when content design was first becoming a thing, we really benefited from people coming in from all kinds of backgrounds, kind of establishing their own processes and ways of working. And now it feels like some of that is getting lost, and a lot of best practice talk and a lot of the same people saying their side of things very strongly and not really letting others maybe do things their own way, which I always think is important. But of course, it doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from, like, especially in tech, there being such a big sense of urgency all the time, and people are stressed and they're looking for ways to streamline their work. And then maybe these things happen. But yeah, I'm curious to know how you think like, do you also see this development in our field? Where do you think it's coming from? What do you think we can do to maybe stop it or hold against it?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Yeah, I see. So I do a lot of mentorship. And what I hear a lot is that perhaps we're forgetting, and maybe it's not content design hiring managers, maybe it's, you know, the rest of the people on the hiring team, or just the hive mind of the hiring team that just kind of happens. But this like selective or collective amnesia to the fact that, you know, probably a couple years ago, a lot of these people were journalists or were copywriters, or like, I've been straddling that line as, you know, a sole copy content person for years, where it's like, you know, you really have to do as much UX writing as content strategy as you do marketing, as you know, I've been in that position. And like, I know a lot of other people came from that, like came from journalism or came from marketing or whatever. And now that content design is starting to become like a discipline, it's like, everybody's like, well, you should have 5 years of working in product to like even be considered. And it's like, why aren't we looking at, you know, all of the other amazing candidates who maybe are coming from academia, or you know, are coming from the care service and things like that, like where they're bringing all of these very different skills that will have a lot of impact on like the culture and the work that actually gets done. And instead it's just kind of like we're looking for people to fit the mold. Right. I think that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Thanks for sharing. All right. So those were three principles. So now we're at number four, if I'm not mistaken. So what's that all about?
Yeah, so just this idea of core to like punk rock has always been this like do-it-yourself mentality. And like the first song that I ever wrote, like somewhere there's a Fisher Price cassette of me at 2 years old singing, I can do it by myself. I can do it by myself. and like, there's a bit of that, like in design, certainly of, you know, a lot of times when we don't have, you know, that documentation or those guidelines or, you know, that foundational strategy, like going out and building that, you know, whether or not we technically have time allotted for it or not, like, you know, going out and doing the research and having conversations and saying like, okay, I'm going to build this, I'm going to do this, or even, you know, research like as kind of DIY research can go of, you know, maybe we don't have time to test this copy, you know, with a researcher or in, you know, a usability test or, you know, in a card sort or, you know, whatever. And taking those things to like friends, family, other coworkers, stuff like that, to like get feedback and just saying like, well, I'm going to go do it. And yeah. And then for me, the balance to that has always been like, I can get in a really bad habit of being like, I'm going to shoulder this burden myself. I think part of that community and part of the DIY concept is like, you know, maybe it's not do it yourself, but we'll do it ourselves. And as a community, and, you know, like, how do I kind of break out of that, you know, right. I guess just really sure. Like that tunnel vision of like, I'm going to do that. Like, I'm just going to do it by myself and no one can help me. Like, I think that can be really dangerous, but it's, you know, a balance in there.
Right. I think that's super interesting. So, yeah, I mean, so much comes from that. And I think it's also, I used to talk about this a lot at the beginning of my career, which now feels like forever ago. But when I was talking to my friends and we were kind of trying to figure out why our lives turned out quite differently from each other. Like, I started freelancing and working for a lot of different clients and companies, and they usually went into pretty stable careers. The one term that always popped up was kind of like the hustle, which is not a term I like. I don't like this term, but I do think hustling is very based on do it yourself and just try to figure it out with the resources you have at hand. So I can definitely relate to this as well.
And you said you're the eldest of siblings,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I'm the same, like, of a younger brother. I wonder if there's something of, like, just being the first born where you're just like, I have to figure it out, or I have to find, like, siblings, yeah, or whatever, like, outside of my immediate family. Like, did you find that when you were a kid where it was kind of like, I'm the eldest, and therefore, like, I have to just figure this out for myself?
Yeah, definitely. I think an additional part for me, at least, was that, like, I'm over 5 years older than my next oldest sister, and then all three of them are very close in age. So it was essentially me versus this army of babies, and my mom needed a lot of support with them. So alone out of that, I guess I had to take a lot of responsibility early on and, like, figure a lot of stuff out because my parents just didn't have the bandwidth. So I would say that was both very difficult. I feel like I burned out quite young, but I think it definitely also had some great advantages for me and how I work today. Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah, that was probably a lot to take on, I imagine.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, it's nice with the big family now. So, I mean, that's great. I think I personally will not have that many children. But we'll see. All right. So let's dive into principle, I think, number 5 it is now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is just this idea of, you know, lift others up. And I think, you know, for all that we've kind of said about, you know, some people are being exclusive or, you know, taking a position of this is the right way to do content design. Like, I went through a particularly difficult time, like, towards the end of 2020. And I don't know to what degree that was influenced by just kind of, like, where I was at, or, you know, the end of, or not the end of, but, you know, that stage of the pandemic, or exactly what. And I had to take kind of a step back and reassess, like, what is it that I want to be doing, and where do I want to focus my efforts? And, like, just started, and that's when I really started, like, getting on LinkedIn a lot, and, you know, just reaching out to people to have conversations, not to say, like, hey, will you hire me, but just, like, to learn more about, you know, all of the work that was being done, because I was really, like, isolated from the community of content designers and didn't know that there was such, like, a rich and diverse collection of people out there doing this similar work. So it was really, like, a wake-up call, and found that just a lot of those people were very welcoming and very warm and willing to have conversations and, you know, talk about what they were doing, and offer to say, like, hey, if you want to meet these people, or if you're ever interested in applying to this company or whatever, like, just let me know. And so, like, I try to carry as much of that as possible into, like, what I do. But yeah, go for it.
Yeah, cool. I think that also relates really closely to your next point, which is around decisions, right?
Yeah, and it's just like, how do you really want to approach your career, but also like, how do you kind of take this punk mindset of like articulate your decisions? So like, how do you go from this very intuitive space into like finding the intelligence based in that? And you know, that can be really challenging, but or I find it really challenging to be like, you know, sometimes the pace of which we all move, it's like you're making intuitive decisions and then like trying to reverse engineer the logic behind it. I don't know if you find that happens to you, but I do feel that sometimes happens pretty regularly where it's like, yeah, what was the rationale behind this? And you're like, give me 5 minutes to figure out like why my brain did this.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I try to not do that anymore, just because I feel like it's often more work to kind of reverse engineer how you got there, but it definitely still happens. And then I realize only later, like, wow, maybe I would have come to a completely different decision if I would have approached it another way. But funnily enough, I often find that intuitive decisions are often pretty good. Like, even if on paper, maybe another decision would have looked better, I very rarely regret going with my gut feeling when it comes to some of the challenges, specifically at work as well, if I'm really honest, actually. And I feel like a lot of people will not like hearing this, but I do think that's also something that definitely comes with experience, especially working on content design. The more problems you work with, you develop this kind of gut feeling for what direction something may go. And then, of course, you still need to do your research and confirm that and make sure you're not biased. But I think that intuition is really, really important and valuable.
Yeah, definitely. And then, like, the, you know, presenting to stakeholders or collaborators, like, I find that still to be challenging after all these many years of just like, how do I very succinctly articulate the decisions that I made and come to the table as an expert who's making a recommendation and not necessarily someone who's looking for approval, which I think can be particularly difficult for people who are early in their career who feel like, you know, I want to be collaborative, I want to be open to feedback and get that approval. But sometimes it's more like, you know, we've done the research, we've set the guidelines, we've, you know, examined the biases, like we now have a recommendation and we can't just like continue to iterate because a stakeholder had an opinion, right? Like, right. Or because they don't like a specific verb.
Right. I mean, I wish it were like that, but unfortunately, I've been in so many situations where we had all that and then still some stakeholder was able to kind of sideline the whole project. So, you know, in an ideal case scenario, yes, but it still doesn't always work.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, someday maybe, but I agree. Like, yeah, that is an ideal scenario.
Right. Okay, so now you've talked us through the six principles, but the seventh may or may not be my favorite. I think it's a really cool one. So what is that about?
Yeah, so just this idea of, you know, the future is unwritten. So for me, who's had some very, has had a, you know, not a, a clear career trajectory, like I started in music and then ended up getting into writing and then, you know, really kind of grew into this particular career. Just being open to like whatever might come next, you know, and for me, like not holding on to the past, and not thinking like, well, I'm going to be a punk in tech and, you know, like somehow, go around necessarily saying like, you know, he's the punk rock content designer, and like that feels like that would probably be disingenuous. It's more just like, you know, there's just a lot of the things that have influenced me, and like now some of those things I need to shed or accept, like, you know, I'm not going to be going on tour, like, making money as, like, a punk musician anymore. Like, I'm at a place where, like, I can throw myself into my career and be interested by that and find the things that I really enjoy and let it take me wherever it takes me instead of, you know, just, like, thinking as though the I can do it by myself mentality of a two-year-old is necessarily going to be the thing that carries me as a 37-year-old, you know, like that those principles need to change and evolve and take on new meaning and context and stuff like that. So always allowing these ideas, because they're ideas and not beliefs, to just like evolve and grow and change however they need to do that.
Wow. Yeah. I really love that. And I think you summarized it perfectly as well. I 100% subscribe to that mentality. And I hope that the industry, well, tech, and then also content design as a discipline, stay open to this kind of mentality, because sometimes I feel like we're trying to do the opposite, where we're trying to really define things for good. And I really don't like that. So many things are constantly changing, and the world is changing, and people are changing. So I think it's important to make sure that we're open to that and open to figuring things out in a new way tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said, Nicole.
Thanks. Sometimes I still like say something useful, but most of the time, ever since having this baby, I have a hard time saying anything cohesive. So that's why I have awesome guests like you on the podcast. So I don't have to, because you save me, right?
No, absolutely. Totally. It's such a joy to always have these conversations with other people who are like-minded and, you know, have that concept of ideas and instead of beliefs and are, you know, not necessarily being prescriptive. And I guess it's really just ending with that of like knowing that I don't have anything to teach anybody, and I think that would be silly of me to you know, ever be in a position where it's like, well, allow me to, you know, tell you how it is, but I can share experience and share, you know, like what I've been through, and then, you know, if that helps somebody, like, glad to have contributed to the greater good. But yeah,
right. I think that's a really great point to end on. But before I let you go, Bill, is there anything else you definitely want to share or mention right now before we wrap it up?
That's a great question. I wish I had found a button for this. and been like, this is how we're going to wrap it up. I'm just going to say, the future is unwritten. Go write it.
Yay, I love that. All right, thank you so much for joining today, Bill.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is an absolute pleasure.
Oh, have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was it for Content Rookie today. As usual, thanks so much for listening. You can find everything in the info box you maybe need. Feel free to ask any questions, send feedback, and so forth. And do tune in again next time. Thanks so much. This is Nicole from Content Rookie. Bye-bye.